Coming up on No Limits, we will continue our discussion on education reform. The debate over how we should structure our schools and serve the state students has heated up even more in the past week. Several bills are moving through the Indiana General Assembly, and some of the state's teachers and Governor Mitch Daniels had a confrontation earlier this week about this topic. We're going to talk today about this hot issue with education leaders, innovators, and experts, and of course you. We'll take your calls at 1-866-476-3881, your emails at nolimits@wfyi.org, and your questions or comments via Facebook and Twitter at WFYI. Please do join this important conversation. First, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We're continuing our conversation today about education innovation and reform. It's going to be an ongoing dialogue. The response to last week's show was so great that we're bringing back, at listeners' request, State Superintendent of Public Instruction Tony Bennett and ISTA, Indiana State Teachers Association leader Nate Schnellenberger, for a March 26th program. Today, we're fortunate to have as our guests some of the most innovative educational leaders in the state of Indiana. We are fortunate to have with us Kaula Murtada, who is the IUPUI Associate Vice Chancellor for Lifelong Learning and the Executive Director of the Community Learning Network. Kaula, welcome to the program. It's good to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Tom Wanicki, who is the Decatur Central High School New Tech Director and Principal. Tom, good to have you here.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. And David Harris, who is the founder and CEO of the Mind Trust. David, good to have you with us.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
I want to start this by talking a little bit about this subject, why people are so focused, what the state of innovation here is in Indiana. It's a somewhat open-ended question, but I want to give you folks a chance here to help us define this subject. We've got a tremendous amount of listener interest in this, so I'm anticipating this is going to become a much more free-flowing dialogue very, very quickly. This may be your one chance to speak exactly your mind, so I would seize it if I were you. Kaula Murtada, if we could start with you, what's the state of innovation?
Well, we've got a lot that's really coming on board now. We've got schools that are saying they've got to improve. We've got ideas from the business community. We've got ideas from nonprofits. We've got ideas from all over the city, all over Marion County, and in the state. All of these different voices are saying we know that education drives an active democracy. A citizenry being better educated is a citizenry that can make change and do it in a thoughtful way. We also have the pressures of the workforce environment, and we know that there is a highly competitive environment, and we've got to prepare our young people for that. And so those conversations are happening, and we've got forces from every which way saying we've got to make a difference in our educational system. It drives the innovation. It drives the change that we need to have.
Tom Wanicki.
I think that it's important to take time to define what type of reform we're after. And if we're after higher test scores and higher graduation rates, that leads to a particular type of reform. And I think with the new tech approach, we're defining reform as changing the pedagogy of the classroom while transforming the culture of the school itself to ensure that students have the skills necessary to be competitive in a global economic situation. The business community has been pretty loud and I think pretty firm in that they need folks that can problem solve, collaborate, and work together to communicate effectively with one another, to work independently, manage their time independently, yet come up with creative solutions to world problems. I think that in a classroom where a person acts as an individual, it's very hard to develop those skills.
David Harris, the Mind Trust.
Well, it's an exciting time in education reform, both in the state of Indiana and the country. There seems to be a real coming together of the need to focus significant energy on improving our public education system. And you're seeing some interesting bipartisan consensus coming together with the President of the United States and here the Governor of Indiana both talking about the importance of things like rewarding excellent teachers and making sure that all the teachers in our schools are highly effective, expanding the number of charter schools. But I think one of the things that's really exciting in this conversation is the conversation around innovation. The President said in his 2010 State of the Union address that it's time to stop funding the status quo and to invest in innovation. And Indianapolis has so many innovative, exciting things. And you're going to hear about from some of the other guests the work that they're doing. But we've got some of the most important national innovative programs in the country, groups like Teach for America and the New Teacher Project that are bringing great teachers into our classroom, College Summit that's helping to ensure that low-income kids go on to college, organizations like Summer Advantage that are helping ensure that kids from low-income backgrounds make academic gains over the summer. So it's a really exciting time for Indianapolis, and we're in a great position to build on all of this focus.
We're talking about education, innovation, and reform. And I'd like to reframe this question real quickly here. I mean, what are some of Kala Murtada of IUPUI, what do you think is the most exciting innovation that is taking place right now?
I think we're paying attention to how children learn.
Okay.
And we're paying attention to it in a way that says we can't just treat all children as if they're the same. We're paying attention to the kinds of curriculum instruction that teachers deliver, but also how children make sense of what they're learning. That's one of the most exciting things. They're doing it in different places, and we're doing it in different environments, and we're paying attention to the cultural differences that young people come. We also are paying attention, and we've got to do this, to the socioeconomic backgrounds that young people come with. And more attention is being drawn to that equity divide, the educational gaps, and people are talking about it and saying, we've got to address these differences in the backgrounds where children come from and really attain the kind of educational environment that can make a difference for all of our young people and that it leads to making a difference in adult learning. And so I think one of this whole idea of paying attention to each one and then recognizing that we're different and that at the same time we have to have quality learning environments, that's one of the most exciting
things. So applying basically the lessons that we're drawing from research now
on
the way and figuring out a way to fit them into some sort of structure so that we teach. David Harris, what do you think is the most exciting innovation in education right now?
You know, there's so many different things, and there's so many different areas where we really need to focus our attention. There's no one magic bullet that's going to fix all the problems. But I think the most important thing in public education, and research is showing this, and we've known this for a long time, and common sense tells us, is the quality of the teacher. We need to do everything we can to make sure that we have an excellent teacher in front of every classroom. And I think organizations like Teach for America and the New Teacher Project are showing that there are new ways to bring extraordinarily talented both young people and mid-career professionals into teaching. There's an organization called Teach Plus that's doing some really exciting work to help ensure that our most successful urban teachers stay in the classroom and engaging them in policy conversations so that they can help create environments that make it so that our best teachers want to stay in the classroom. And so I think probably the most exciting reforms that are happening in our community revolve around excellent teaching.
Tom Winicki.
I would agree with that in that ensuring that teachers have the skills and skill sets necessary to get students to think critically about the information that they're dealing with. And it's really interesting in America how traditionally in a classroom learning was an individual activity. And yet throughout our life it's never an individual activity. When, you know, an architecture firm wants to put forth a great product, you have groups of people solving that problem together. And I think that the most exciting aspect of being in part of the New Tech Network is that this is a systematic approach to giving teachers the supports they need to implement change. So I think that I agree that giving teachers the opportunity to learn How to acquire these new skills is absolutely imperative.
Tom, real quickly, could you explain what the new tech curriculum is?
So we are
not every listener here has been privileged to go to your school. So
right, thank you. Project-based learning is the heart of our instructional approach, and it uses technology and inquiry to engage students in issues and questions that are relevant to their lives. In new tech classrooms, teachers design very rigorous projects that align to state and district standards and the Common Core. And then teachers customize the projects for relevance to provide students the skills for today's world. Now, what that really means is that students are able to see why we're learning this information. You go into a traditional classroom and typically ask a student, why are you learning this? And they'll typically respond, because it's on the test. It has no context. It has no meaning. And so by providing rigorous projects that have real-world problems, the students understand why they're learning what they're learning.
Calla, you had a point you wanted to make.
I think one of the things that we've got to address is the fact that we identify bits and pieces. You asked what was one of the things that's happening. There's all kinds of research that show very clearly that you can't just take one piece of the system of education and work on it and expect for systemic change. You can't take one piece and do it. You've got to think systemically. And so what we're finding is that teachers absolutely make a difference, but so do school leaders make a difference. So does the curriculum make a difference. And so does the parent engagement and community engagement make a difference. And so unless we look at the systems of change, what we wind up doing is tinkering. We really need to pay attention to connecting the dots. What we're doing at with the Talent Alliance, for example, and I'll talk a little bit about that when you come back around to it, is to look at how do we pay attention to connecting those dots. It's not enough to prepare excellent leaders, building principals, curriculum leaders, and they can't work with excellent teachers. So we need them as well. And so we've got to have meaningful curriculum that makes a difference, that engages young people, has them understand the relevancy and the rigor of the material and why do they have to learn it. And not because it's just on a test. They have to know it's going to be on the test, but that's not enough to get a young person to say, I'm committed to staying in school and learning. One of the reasons that we have a major dropout crisis in Central Indiana, and we have to address that, is because we are not engaging the young people, and we have to think about it some more. But we'll come back to those kind of issues.
We're talking about education, innovation, and reform, and I'd like to invite our listeners to join this conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You also can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send comments or questions via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Joseph, welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate you taking my call.
Certainly. Sure. Glad to do it. You have a question for us?
I do. I'm really glad to hear you guys talking about innovation this week, as opposed to last week and a little bit during the State of the State address by Governor Daniels, where the emphasis seemed to be more on minimum graduation requirements and, you know, bringing everybody up to a minimum level. I'd like to point out an institution that we have in Indiana that is extremely innovative. It's been around since 1990. It's the Indiana Academy for Science, Mathematics, and Humanities, which is a boarding high school for juniors and seniors that are gifted and talented. And this year, the Academy is facing a crippling budget cut of 15%. And my question is, with all the talk about minimum requirements and getting just, you know, the community at large to graduate, where is the discussion about those outliers, those really gifted and talented kids that need a place to go that's publicly funded that maybe their parents can't afford or something like that? I was just curious if the conversation could include the other side, the other end of the spectrum.
Good question. Thank you, Joseph. So, do we do enough to challenge folks on the upper end of the spectrum? I suppose that's not an appropriate metaphor as we do to the lower end.
Well, I think the answer to that is clearly no. We need to be focusing on all of our kids. I do think it's appropriate, given the dire circumstances that some of our kids face, that we focus a lot of our attention on our neediest students. And that's particularly true because our neediest students, when given the right supports, the right conditions, can not just get by, they can excel as well. And so I think sometimes people forget that there are disadvantaged students who are capable of doing just as good a work as any other students in our community.
We are talking about education, innovation, and reform here on No Limits with our guest David Harris, founder and CEO of the Mind Trust, Callum Hurtado, who is IUPUI Associate Vice Chancellor for Lifelong Learning, and Tom Winicki, who is the Decatur Central High School New Tech Director and Principal. We're going to be talking a lot about education, reform, and innovation. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We're talking about education, innovation, and reform, having a lively dialogue with our guests, Callum Hurtado, IUPUI Associate Vice Chancellor for Lifelong Learning and the Executive Director of the Community Learning Network, David Harris, founder and CEO of the Mind Trust, and Tom Winicki, Decatur Central High School New Tech Director and Principal. I don't think people really need encouragement. They seem to care an awful lot about education, but I'm going to give the 800 number again and encourage people to call. The number is 1-866-476-3881. You also can send questions via email at nolimits@wfyi.org or via Facebook and Twitter at WFYI. We're looking forward to having you participate in this conversation because it is a fascinating one. Joseph asked a question here about really whether we're focusing so much attention on lifting minimum standards and all of that, whether we are focusing enough on challenging the most gifted students. Calla, you seem to have strong feelings on that for the moment. So I'm going to invite you to speak to Joseph's question.
I think one of the things that we have to be able to do is to recognize that young people come to school ready to learn. We often say they're not ready to learn. When they come to school ready to learn, we have to create those learning environments that picks up on the kinds of learning that the young people really can and want to engage in. We have to attend to that. Many talents and gifts are not assessed in the typical testing mode. And so until we begin to look at different kinds of assessment, we won't recognize the gifts and talents that many of us bring. I would be remiss to say that some of the gifts and talents that I know that you come with and that you bring and that our public and listeners can bring are often missed in most traditional assessment environments. And so until we pay attention to the arts, until we pay attention to the crafts and things that make a difference in the development of a young person, their different skills, knowledges, abilities, talents get often overlooked. And I believe that a rich learning environment like what you've described can really make a difference in that.
Tom Winicki, what do you do at Decatur Central to challenge the gifted students?
So I think that the beauty of project-based learning is it allows students to engage in information and technology from a position of interest and strength. So, you know, for example, a really terrific project that we did this last year, students were asked a driving question, which was, how do we help people in Africa not die from ill-prepared meat? It's a major cause of death. And you would think, what type of curriculum is going to deal with that? Well, that was a curriculum taught in a physics, transportation systems, and communication systems course. And the students were challenged to bring the temperature of meat to 160 degrees and sustain it for 30 minutes without using electricity or gas because those aren't available there. Inevitably, students had to learn about light waves and heat energy and the sun as a heat source. And they ended up developing solar cookers based on what they learned from the physics. I can't imagine sitting in a classroom and having as rich of an experience as that if they're taking notes and answering questions on a worksheet. I think that type of learning engages students of all ability levels and allows them to engage in meaningful learning that's making a difference in the world.
A perfect example is over at Indianapolis Public Schools. They have a Center for Inquiry. They raise those kinds of questions so that the young people begin to know and ask what kinds of things make a difference in their own learning.
We've gotten an email question from Julie Dunlap that picks up on a point that we were talking about before the break. Julie says, a great teacher is wonderful, but when dealing with an oversized class with kids of all different learning levels with no teaching assistance, we're asking the teacher to do his or her job with one hand tied behind his or her back. Add the lack of discipline and respect from the students, and the cards are stacked against any teacher. Let's expect great things from our teachers, but let's make sure we give the supports and resources that make it possible for them to do their jobs effectively. Do we do enough to support teachers? David Harris.
Well, I think we don't do enough to support our teachers. I think our teachers are some of the most important people in our community and in our country, and we need to value teachers more. If it were up to me, we would pay teachers $100,000 a year if they're effective and producing significant gains for their kids. But I think we also need to recognize sometimes people think that kids from certain circumstances aren't going to be successful, and we talk about all the challenges that they bring to the table, and there's no question that teaching in certain schools with kids from certain backgrounds present challenges, but we also know from evidence around our community and around the country that teachers facing those kinds of circumstances and facing those kinds of challenges rise to the occasion and perform incredible work. That does not mean that we shouldn't continue to strive to provide as much support to them as possible and to create the best conditions, but we should never use as an excuse the difficult circumstances that we face in some of our schools for why kids aren't excelling.
We're talking about education innovation and reform with our guests, Kaula Murtada, Tom Winicki, and David Harris. Joseph, I understand you're calling from Greenwood, and you've got a question that's kind of on point here.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call.
Certainly. Thank you for joining the program.
I teach students, too, and I'm a medical doctor. I teach medical students. When we write the references, to use that term, excellent, we have a consensus that that's the top 5% of performers are excellent and excel, and that's how we use that term. And I heard the statement, we want an excellent teacher in front of every classroom. And I'm just wondering, what about all the other teachers who don't excel and that 95% that don't meet that excellent criterion? What future would you see for them?
Good question. Thank you, Joseph. David Harris, since they seem to be directing a lot of these questions your way, what would you say, I think, if I can reframe Joseph's questions ever so slightly, how should we define excellence in teaching? I don't think we've arrived at that definition in this program yet. And what do we do to help teachers get there? We'll start with you, David, and then I'll take it around the horn.
Well, first of all, I understand the caller's point about the top 5% of physicians may be what they define as excellent. I think in teaching and learning, the question isn't trying to define a certain percentage. I think the question is, are there teachers that are making significant gains with students? And obviously, this is a controversial topic. People don't think that we should evaluate teachers solely on test scores, although that, in my view, needs to be a significant part of the equation. We're also going to get better at evaluating teachers. There are a lot of resources at the federal government. Foundations like the Gates Foundation are putting a lot of money into coming up with better models and metrics for evaluating teachers. IPS has recently adopted a new metric for evaluating teachers, so we need to continue to get better. But we also know that some teachers aren't making the kinds of progress with their kids that they need to. And there was a recent study that came out and said that if we replace the bottom 6 to 10% of teachers with just average teachers, we could cut the achievement gap more than in half. And so the caliber of the teacher is essential. They need to be measured by the kinds of growth that they're making with students, but there needs to be a more comprehensive evaluation. So it's not just about test scores, but we do need to make sure kids are learning the core subject matters.
Kaula Murtada.
Teachers can't do the work by themselves. We need to be very clear about that. We don't expect that all teachers can teach all children all the time when there are differences in the communities and the backgrounds that children come from. Teachers need to be able to be supported with health issues. Teachers need to be supported with the addressing of mental health, physical health, all kinds of issues that are really facing a lot of our children. Their children are living in challenging environments, challenging communities, and so we need to have what's one of the innovations, and it's happening nationally, or what are called full-service community schools. Full-service community schools provide those wraparound services that children and their families need in order to be able to address the educational environment. A child can't come to school with a toothache and be able to perform well in school. A child can't come to school if they've come from a family and that their tensions and things that have happened in the home. So they might need some mental health support, or their family might need those things. Teachers, when they have those kind of support mechanisms, can address the real issue why they're in that classroom, and that is for excellent teaching.
Are there full-service schools in place here in the state, and if so, where are they?
We just received funding to support the development of 3 full-service schools right over on the east side of Indianapolis. We have one on the west side of Indianapolis that's been in place for a number of years, and it's showing graduation rates that are incredible. Students are going to college, and they're being accepted. This is the George Washington Community School. Mm-hmm. It's a full-service school. The university supports it. Community agency supports it. Supports the school, and we make sure that the kinds of wraparound services I was referring to a moment ago really are there in the building. Parents can come to the school. It attracts parents, community organizers, people who are engaged to make a difference.
Tom Winicki, as someone who is in a school every day and obviously working in this environment, I'm going to ask you to draw on that experience and tell me, what is one concrete way that we could support teachers better and maybe promote the idea of excellence for teachers? One concrete suggestion.
I think that this whole conversation begs the question of what type of behavior do you need to see out of students in order to be reasonably sure that they are engaged in learning? If students are sitting passively at a desk, taking notes or doing a worksheet or whatnot, you know, you'll have some that look like they're engaged, but they're not necessarily interacting with this information. So I think that the type of concrete things that I have seen for my staff in working with New Tech Network is the idea of developing curriculum that is relevant, is rigorous, but engages students in the learning process. I recently had a visitor a couple of days ago to our school, and the person responded back. I had to keep reminding myself that I was talking to 15-year-olds because they sounded so adult in our interaction, because they were talking about rubrics and essentially metacognition. Mm-hmm. They were thinking about what they're thinking.
Just for keep in mind, when you talk, what do you define metacognition here?
So they're thinking about thinking.
Okay.
They're thinking about what they're learning and why they're learning it and where it fits in their lives and in this world. And I think that working with the school development coaches from the New Tech Network, mm-hmm. Through their training systems that is very structured for the staff, allowed the teachers to learn what they needed to learn to engage the students.
I'm John Kroll. We're having a real lively conversation about education innovation and reform with our guests, Callum Ritata, Tom Winicki, and David Harris. Alice, I understand that you are a retired IPS teacher. Well, thanks
yes,
for joining the program.
Thank you. I just think this is an excellent discussion, but I believe that one really important facet is being overlooked by the discussion and by the governor's State of the State address, when he failed to note what research shows could be close to a magic bullet, and that's early childhood education. When we learned that 75% of the children in IPS do not have fathers, we know that that puts additional stress on the mothers, and those mothers don't have time to help their children with homework or with reading readiness, perhaps. And so Indiana is one of the few states in the country that doesn't have full-day kindergarten. I think we need full-day kindergarten, and we need even more preschool education.
Thank you for the call, Alice. Really appreciate it. Callum Ritata, you were all but saying amen when she was talking.
I did say amen.
Okay.
We've got to be able to put those resources that we have, and we have limited resources in some respects, we've got to put them in early childhood education. It's a no-brainer. Organizations all around Central Indiana right now are focusing on early childhood education, and we've got to do it. Your next-door neighbor to WFYI, PNC, is convening groups to be able to do that kind of thing. The United Way is convening groups to be able to do that with the Success by Six initiative. The university is really pushing quality early childhood education. But I referenced a few moments ago the need not to just focus on one area. We need to pay attention to systemic change. We have to pay attention to the continuum. We have breaks in our continuum, or our pipeline, if we will, in education. What happens after a young child leaves from a quality, and we need quality, high quality, early childhood environments, and they go into an environment, and at the third and fourth grade level, they're not reaching those literacy skills that they need to develop.
David Harris.
Well, I couldn't agree more with Dr. Murtada, and I think it's extraordinarily unfortunate that we do not fund full-day kindergarten and early childhood education. I understand that we're one of eight states that doesn't offer any sort of preschool funding. And there's ample research from researchers on a variety of ends of the kind of ideological spectrum that show that making an investment in an early childhood education can pay significant dividends. I do think a couple of other points related, though. I think Dr. Murtada is exactly right, though. That alone isn't going to change the outcomes of our educational system. We need to focus on other areas as well. So there is no one single investment we could make. It's a hugely important one. It's extremely unfortunate that we're not doing it. But I think the other thing that's I think needs to be part of this conversation is, where are we prioritizing our resources? There's a huge amount of resources that is going into our K-12 system. It does not look like the state is in a situation where they're going to be able to come up with significant resources for full-day kindergarten and preschool, as I think we would all want them to do. And so, given how important early childhood education is, shouldn't we be looking about shifting the resources in the current system into that incredibly important function? And that may mean we have to make some difficult decisions. But if early childhood education is as important as I believe it is, and I think others believe it is, I think we need to have that conversation. Right now in IPS, less than half of the resources they get make it down to the classroom. Maybe those dollars are being well spent, but it's hard to imagine a better, more useful investment than early childhood education. So shouldn't we as a community be shifting our resources into that very, very important area?
Dr. Murtada.
Not long ago, the Chamber of Commerce decided it wanted to make a difference in the dropout rates and high school completion. And they rallied the troops. They brought in resources from every foundation, from the business community, and they said, let's address the dropout crisis. If we look along the continuum from early childhood on up to elementary, middle school, high school, and into college, we've got to recognize that we have limited resources, but it's interesting that we decide what we want to put our money into when we believe that that's very important. And we get millions of dollars poured into a particular area, and we say we will make a difference. They began making a difference in the high school dropout and high school completion rate. How do we sustain those differences is what is really important here.
I want to reframe this a little bit, because I think we probably all could agree at some level that it's unfortunate that education has become as politicized as it has, and it really doesn't enhance the process. I think we also all would agree that it's beyond our power to change that, that that's the way it's going to be. But I'm going to ask you to sort of, Tom Wernicke, I'm going to go to you first, because you unfortunately made eye contact at the wrong moment, and say, suppose we gave you absolute power to restructure education in America. What would you do first? Give me a short answer, and then we'll come back around and let people amplify their thoughts.
Well, I'm going to ask a question. That's going to be my answer. What is the purpose of education? What do we want the resultant to be? When we look at the most successful students in America, those that are going to four-year colleges, what is their success rate in college? Well, the research bears out that about 50% make it to their degree. So we have a success rate of what comes next at about a 50%. So I think that we have to, I think you've got it, you've nailed it, in that we have to do systemic change to not only instruction, but also in child preparation for school.
We're talking about education, innovation, and reform here on No Limits. I am John Krall, talking with three very fascinating guests. Please stay with us. Welcome to No Limits. I'm John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We're talking about education, innovation, and reform with David Harris, founder and CEO of the Mind Trust, Callum Murtada, who is IUPUI Associate Vice Chancellor for Lifelong Learning, Executive Director of the Community Learning Network. That's a long title, Cal. Got a lot of duties there. And Tom Wanicki, who is Decatur Central High School's New Tech Director and Principal, asked a question right before we went to the break about you really, if you were given absolute power to restructure education, what would you do? Tom reframed it by tossing back a question saying, what do we want the system to do, basically? What do we do? Tom, I know we were running up against a wall and you didn't get complete chance to formulate your thought. You want to take a few more seconds?
I think the system that we have currently was designed about 100 years ago to sort students, to sort people out, and did so in an industrial model where students progressed through stages linearly. And so if you were 9, you were with other 9-year-olds, whether you needed to be with 9-year-olds or 12-year-olds. And so that type of structure allows students, you know, if a student is reading delayed, they're behind. And so they either get held behind or they get shuffled out of the system. That's what it was designed to do. I believe that the question is, you know, can we change the home environments? I, as an educator, can't change my students' home environments. But do I control enough to make a difference for that student? I believe we do. I believe that if you engage students in relevant, rigorous curriculum, you'll capture them. If they don't see relevance in it, you won't capture them, and you'll just sort them out. So we can talk about, you know, all of that, graduation rates and test scores. We can get test scores and we can get graduation rates. But can we prepare students for what comes next? That really needs to be our question.
David Harris, I'm going to give everybody a chance to create their dream educational system here.
Well, that may be beyond what I'm able to offer. But I think what I would do, if we could wave a magic wand, is to shift decision-making and resources down to the school level. We have a tremendous amount of resources in the system. I think if we reprioritized the way we spend those dollars, we could pay teachers substantially more. We could pay principals and school leaders who are, as Dr. Murtada said, absolutely critical. We could give them the resources to invest in the innovative programs that are proving to make a significant difference. And then in exchange for that, we need to hold those schools to higher levels of accountability. So we give them decision-making authority and authority over budgets and have more resources available to them. But then we have to hold them to a higher standard of accountability. And if they don't perform, then they need to be moved on. And I would also create more choice. I think the more parents have the ability to select the best school for their kids, and the more that schools have to work to make sure that parents want to stay in their school, the better system we're going to have.
Callum Murtada.
It's an interesting thing that we focus on, and we should, young children and our system for educating our young children. But we also have to look at the fact that we have a huge population of adults who have not finished their education. And when I mean finished, I mean I believe in lifelong learning. Mm-hmm. But who have finished that bachelor's degree or some form of post-secondary education. We know, the literature shows us, the research shows us, that an educated adult makes a big difference in young people's lives. So we have to think cyclically about this. There's a circular pattern of poorly educated adults that has an impact on young people's learning. And so if we've invested money in people finishing their education, or at least finishing a 2-year degree or a 4-year degree or some form of certificate or certification, that makes a difference in our young people and the kind of support that they get at home in their home environments, because parents model that excellence in education.
We're having a fascinating conversation about education, innovation, and reform. I'd like to invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Anne, I understand you're calling from Indianapolis. Why is it, and you've got a question about finding resources for children.
Yes, I have a child in the Pike Township year-round school, mm-hmm. and it has taken me about 8 months to get her tested for a learning disability after requesting it several times. I wonder why there's such a fight with the school in having that done. It should not be any reflection on the school if my child has a learning disability, but she's not learning, and she's in seventh grade. And if I didn't stand up and fight for her, she would graduate Pike High School with a fifth grade reading level and probably maybe fifth or sixth grade math. And that's okay with them.
Good question.
Why is that okay?
We will take it up. Thank you. Thank you, Ann.
I have a child in the accelerated program as well. So.
Okay. Well, thank you for the question, and we'll take it around the horn. Thank you. Do we make it more difficult than we should for parents and students to get the help and support they need? Callum Murtada.
We have layers of bureaucracy in almost every form of what we do in education. We talk about the importance of the teacher, and we talk about the importance of the curriculum, but we do create barriers for parents, and we need to be able to make it much more accessible for parents to get the kind of support that they need for their children's education. I find, and I referenced earlier, full-service community schools where you have parent liaisons, mm-hmm. parents who actually can talk with other parents and say, let's move these barriers out of the way. Good principals understand that. Good superintendents understand that, too. And we've got to move the barriers. Bureaucracy kills us.
I'm gonna take another caller right now. Susanna, because I think it's on point with what Calla was just saying. Suzanne, you're calling from Martinsville, and you've got a question actually about the role of principals, right?
Yeah, outside in the country there. Yes, I'm a sociologist, and actually I used to teach my unit on education about whoever coined the term social promotion, an oxymoron, ought to be put in jail. But anyway, I've read quite a few reports of schools, stellar schools, working with not your highly motivated populations all over the country, from California to New York City, that have turned around average-seeming populations and made a very, very fine schools out of them. And in every case, it was because of a dedicated principal who basically instilled motivation and high expectations for the students, for the teachers, students, and of course also worked in many ways, usually on the parents. And so you've probably read of these studies, and I'm a sociologist, I'm not talking about one or two. This is a major factor, and in fact without it, I don't know how you can get anywhere. The question is how to institutionalize this role of the principal as the leader with high expectations. One of your commentators just mentioned the role of the principal in the education schools at the state level. But, you know, this has been a personal choice and mission, as I understand it, on the part of all these stellar schools, public schools, private, charter, that's not important. It's the role of the principal with those expectations, those people standing at the doors welcoming every student whose name they know.
Great. Thanks for the question, Suzanne.
Sure.
Thank you. Okay, the role really here of principals in this mix, would it be self-serving for me to throw that one to you, Tom? Or?
Well, that's quite a burden to bear.
Tom, for those who have just joined us, is the principal at Decatur Central and director of the New Tech.
I'm the director of New Tech. I'm not the principal of the high school itself. So just want to give a shout out there to Mr. Joe Prada, who makes my job much easier. I think that we've talked about systemic approach to this, and I think that when we look at education itself, if we continue to teach in the style and manners as we always have, after 100 years of teaching that way, we can predict what type of results we're going to get. And I think then that we have to change the pedagogy of the classroom. How is the teacher teaching? And I think that teacher preparation programs need to change. I think principal prep programs need to change. Working with the University of Indianapolis Woodrow Wilson Fellows program, where they're teaching their curriculum in a project-based learning style, are giving teachers a better grasp of how to engage students. But again, I want to go back to an outside organization, New Tech Network, being a professional development organization, helping me to learn to think differently and to ask more questions and speak less, which is sometimes a struggle for me. You know, to give ownership to my staff to make decisions and give ownership to students to set the cultural levels of our school. That's a whole paradigm shift. And sometimes you need an outside organization to come in and hold your hand a little bit and say it's going to be okay. So,
David Harris, that seems to be also in your ballpark a little bit. What should we be doing to both find and then train and support better leadership in our schools?
Well, we think it's absolutely critical to have great leaders in the school, and we need to create new pipelines of talent to make sure that our most talented people some of the most talented people in our community are going into those classrooms, are going into those school buildings as leaders. One of the organizations we work with, Teach for America, has just developed a program in collaboration with Columbia University to help train future school leaders, both for IPS and for some of the local charter schools. But I wanted to just take a moment to go back to the previous caller from Pike Township, because you could really hear the frustration in her voice. And I know that's something that a lot of parents feel, that they're not being listened to. They don't have an opportunity to have their voice heard in the system. And when it's your kids, obviously you take that very, very seriously. And I do think it's really important that we find ways to empower parents so that they feel like they have a much stronger voice, that they're the most important. Obviously, the kids are the most important, but families are the most important constituents of schools. And one of the things that I think we need to do is to create more choice, so families have the opportunity to look at a variety of schools, and schools have to work to make sure that those families select their school. But one thing I thought I would just throw out is a very interesting proposal that was just passed in the charter legislation that passed out of the House this week that actually gives parents the ability to convert an existing district school into a charter school. If 51% of parents sign a petition and then they can get an authorizer to approve a plan, they can convert the school to a charter school. That is a radical change, but it's something that shifts a significant amount of power to the parents. And I think it's a fascinating proposal, and one that I think deserves a lot more attention in the conversation around all the education reforms.
Yeah, I feel like we could talk about the whole charter school choice thing, and I don't think we're going to get it done in about the 3 minutes we have left here. So I think instead, Jennifer, I understand you've got a question really about innovation in regard to a different sort of student.
Yes, my question was about special education. Mm-hmm. I work on a regular basis with families to help them understand Article 7 and how they can advocate for their child, but I see a whole lot of frustration on both the parent and the teacher's side of just not knowing what to do. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if there is any innovation going on in that area.
Good question. Thank you, Jennifer, mm-hmm. for the call. Callum or Tata?
Two areas that we're looking at, and I think it ties back to the earlier comments that we were talking about in terms of leadership. What we've done, and we see this in excellent schools of education, and we have many across the state, many of those schools of education are better preparing teachers to not only major in particular subject areas, but to also have a strong background and understanding in special needs children, understanding that we have a wide range of abilities and disabilities with our young people, an excellent teacher, a good teacher who understands the pedagogy, as was referenced earlier, but also begins to understand how do you, and I mentioned this at the very beginning of the program, how do you pay attention to that individual child's special needs? Good building principals or leaders understand that too. And when they have that meeting to discuss the IEP, those principals are seeing the parent as getting empowered and supported so that the parent begins to understand how the teacher sees what's going on, and the parent comes to the table with that. Anybody that says, okay, it's easy to be a principal, it's easy to be a teacher, misses that key piece of preparation that prepares you to understand special needs children. And excellent schools of education are saying principal leaders need to do that as well as teacher leaders. They prepare to understand more about special needs children.
Tom Wernicke, are there places we can use technology to better serve?
I think that it absolutely can. And And, you know, as a new technology school, we get the misnomer that we're about technology. But what we really are about is engaging students in relevant learning. I can't get too excited of sitting at a desk and listening to the teacher lecture to me. I can't get very excited about that as a person. If you're a special needs student and you've got that roadblock, it's doubly hard. So you've got to change the instruction. And I absolutely think technology can play a role, but what it really comes down to is you have to change instruction.
David Harris, what could we do in about 30 seconds to better serve special needs students?
Well, I think my co-panelists have said excellent things. Just a one point that I would add,
sure.
And that is, and I think this subject matter illustrates the value of bringing in people from a variety of backgrounds to help deal with the issues that public education face. One of the things that we do is support a program that brings people from other professions into teaching. And I was talking to Brandon Cosby, who's the principal of Shortridge High School, who had one of these people teaching in his building. She was a former lawyer who decided to go teach special education, and she brought an incredible amount of energy and knowledge and skill that helped that building really better serve special needs kids because of her unique background.
I'd like to thank my listeners, obviously, for helping to make this a very, very lively program, and the folks we've been fortunate enough to have as our guests, David Harris, founder and CEO of the Mind Trust. David, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Callum Murtada, IUPUI Associate Vice Chancellor for Lifelong Learning and Executive Director of the Community Learning Network, and Tom Winicki, Decatur Central High School New Tech Director and Principal. Thank you for joining us. We're going to talk about the Super Bowl next week and resume this conversation on March 24th. Please see us next week when we talk about the Super Bowl. Thank you for being with us.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Radio, 90.1 FM and HD1. Producer, Sharon Allseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Cedric Freeman. Board Engineers, Matt Sosi and Josh Hamig. And intern, Savannah Rains. We invite you to join us each Thursday at noon for No Limits, and you can listen online at WFYI.org.